Hello, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm David Rogowski, and today I will be reading from Outside Magazine. First article is, he fell 200 feet during a trail running race, and lived to tell the tale. Not all trail races are created equally. 22-year-old collegiate trail running champion Stuart Terrell learned the very hard way at the U.S. Mountain Running Championships last summer. This is by Andy Wacker. Stuart Terrell's life forever changed in a blink of an eye during a competitive mountain running race this past summer. July 13th, the 22-year-old from Crozet, Virginia, summited an 11,000-foot hidden peak at Snowbird Ski Resort above Salt Lake City. He was an hour into 8.7-mile Cirque Series race, serving double duty as the 2024 USA Track and Field Mountain Running Championships. Terrell had just graduated from the University of Richmond, where he ran cross-country and track and double major in leadership and communication. But he's no stranger to the trails. He won the Collegiate Trail Running Championship in Fairfax, Virginia in May, besting the competition by nearly a minute over the 10K course to earn his second straight Collegiate Trail Running Championship title. As he crested Hidden Peak and started bombing down the other side, Terrell passed a competitor and lost control, sending him careening towards a cliff. Photographer Matt Johnson watched in horror, pivoting to try to catch Terrell before he fell, but he was too late. Terrell toppled over the edge and tumbled more than 200 feet down the jagged, unforgiving terrain below. He swung wide to pass a runner. His momentum sent him barreling down towards me, and I dropped my camera to try and grab him, Johnson recalled in the resort's incident report. I heard his terrified scream as he went out of sight down the rocky gully. At this point, I screamed for a medic and life flight because I wasn't sure if he was even going to survive. It was rough. It was one of the most horrifying things I've ever witnessed. Terrell suffered numerous broken bones, 8 vertebrae, 4 ribs, his right collarbone, left wrist, right kneecap, and several bones in each of his feet, and was lucky to be alive. As his mangled body was taken away in a medical helicopter, all those on the scene could do was wonder, how did such a perilous accident happen? In its safety advisories on its website and emails to participants, the event warns that it is imperative for your safety you follow a precise path of flagging. Terrell's fall was not the result of course marking issue. He simply made a risky passing move at an unfortunate spot on the course. We are very familiar with the exact spot of this accident, said Julian Carr, the race director of the Cirque Series. We will place people as backstop in that exact corner and ensure no one ever has a fall in that spot ever again. Mountain running, a contact sport? While many may be initially attracted to running on the track and roads precisely because of its relatively low-risk profile, no contact that could lead to a concussion, no explosive movements that could result in an acute injury, trail running, and in particular mountain running, is another matter. In fact, mountain running, a fast, explosive trail running discipline that usually involves running over rocky, uneven terrain and climbing and descending peaks, comes with considerable risk. Many mountain running races take competitors along high cliffs and ridgelines with exposure and down steep off-trail descents through technical terrain. Minor falls are common, and sprained ankles, broken collarbones, and skin-devouring trail rash are among the most typical injuries. Injuries are common enough that some races, including the Pikes Peak Marathon in Manitou Springs, Colorado, give out an award for the bloodiest runner. Mount Marathon, a short mountain race in Seward, Alaska, reports several minor injuries in a typical year. In 2012, it suffered its first presumed death when 66-year-old Michael Lemaitre fell on a steep section of the course and inexplicably was never found. Although it wasn't a super-fast, shorter-distance mountain running race, American runner Hillary Allen survived one of the worst-known trail running accidents in 2017 at the 57K Hampurkakken Sky Race in the mountains outside of Tromsø, Norway, after she tripped and ragdolled 150 feet down a ridge and broke both arms, 2 vertebrae, several ribs, and numerous bones in her feet. Like Terrell, she was lucky to have survived. We acknowledge the inherent danger of producing races in the high alpine. Injuries are rare, but do happen, unfortunately, Carr says. This is by far the most serious injury at a Cirque race since we started races in 2015. We take safety of our runners as first priority. Mountain running races bring on increased danger for highly competitive athletes, especially because the terrain is often extremely technical, varies so greatly, and is often race site unseen. In addition, elite runners are often willing to take risk on high consequence terrain. That is the difference between performing well and getting left in the dust of those who do. Is this risk-taking an allure or consequence of the sport? And what level of responsibility do race organizers play in keeping competitors safe? Carr says the event's emergency response plan is an integral part of planning and preparing for the event, and it begins well in advance of race day. We put a lot of thought into our safety maps, Carr says. When we mark the course, I chat with our safety director about optimal EMT, patrol, and volunteer placements throughout the day. Once we finish marking course, we have a meeting to determine all safety personnel placements for the race. Then we generate the safety map. We provide digital copies and printed copies to all safety personnel for race day. Brendan Madigan, who operates the Broken Arrow Sky Race at Palisades Tahoe Ski Resort every June, says having multi-layered medical and risk teams is essential. Broken Arrow Sky Race, like the Cirque Series, goes to great lengths to organize emergency response teams with certified medical personnel and mountain rescue experts in key locations. We come from a much more dangerous world of ski mountaineering and climbing, so trail running might seem pretty vanilla compared to that. But you have to be organized and prepared, Madigan says. You've got to make sure you're protecting everyone and have a consistent level of safety. Not all trails are created equally. Terrell isn't new to trail running. In fact, he ran his first trail race in middle school, a mile and a half course with 100 feet of elevation gain in central Virginia. While running cross country and track at the University of Richmond, he also went on to win the Collegiate Trail Running National Championships in both 2023 and 2024. As a junior in 2023, he took the national title at the Thunder Bunny 11K trail race in Athens, Ohio, in 41 minutes and 27 seconds, setting the course record by a minute and a half. That's when he knew he had a thing for off-road running. Then this past May, he repeated as national champ by winning the Fountainhead 10K++ trail run in Virginia, obliterating the course records by 6.5 minutes and 44 minutes and 55 seconds. I've always trained in hilly locations, and my stride worked well on trails, Terrell says. Those trail racers were sent on rolling single-track courses through the forest. They didn't have the exposure and steep profile of the race in Utah. Still, Terrell was eager to give it a try. After graduating this spring, he was at a crossroads. He had one more season of cross-country eligibility, which he intended on using as a graduate student at the University of Richmond, but he was also drawn to the idea of going all-in on trail running and trying to make the U.S. team for the final of the 2024 World Mountain Running Association World Cup in Italy this October. That required finishing first or second among a talented field of runners at the snowbird race. I wanted to make the U.S. team. In the back of your mind, you don't know how good everyone is before you compete, Terrell says. You have to try. Making a U.S. team, whether that's on trails or the track, representing the USA is my ultimate goal in the sport. If nothing else, he figured to get in some quality post-collegiate running experience while he figured out his next steps in running and life, as well as a fun trip out west. In over his head. After driving out to Utah and previewing the start of the snowbird course, Terrell felt on edge. The steep, exposed terrain looked nothing like the Virginia trails to which he was accustomed. He couldn't decide if he wanted to treat the race as a training run and save himself for the cross-country season, or alter his training to meet the specificity needed to do well on a high alpine peak at altitude. He settled on aiming for the win in the collegiate division of the Utah race. The day before, I was checking out the course and got excited, Terrell says. It's time to race. I wanted to race for the win. Workouts were going well. Those ambitions went out the window in the starting gun. Turns out pro-level mountain running on rugged terrain is quite a bit different than ex-collegiate trail running on more mellow courses. These guys are built differently, Terrell says of the competitive field, which included 2023 Speed Goat 50K champion Christian Allen and 2x Pikes Peak Marathon winner Seth Damore. It isn't a track race. Right away, the lofty altitude and rugged terrain took their toll on Terrell. Hoofing it up the climb well behind race leader Allen, he negotiated with himself. His goal became to finish without walking. Just make it up the hill and it'd be a good 4-mile workout, he thought. I was further back place-wise in the race than I wanted to be, Terrell says. All I knew about the course is that it was technical in areas. Upon cresting the summit, he got hit with a huge wave of energy. He started bombing down the technical terrain, which included loose dirt, rocks, and small boulders that grew steeper by the step. It's super rocky and I was going too fast. All you can think about is putting one foot in front of the other. Stay upright, Terrell recalls. Reaching out towards the photographer's arm, I thought, I'm going to die here. I won't get to say goodbye to my girlfriend, my parents. Those close to me are going to get a phone call. I'm dead. A selfless act. Matt Daniels, a professional trail runner from Boulder, Colorado, was racing ahead of Terrell when he witnessed a horrifying fall. I happened to look back right as it occurred and saw Terrell midair completely out of control before he landed on a boulder about 180 feet down, Daniels remembers. He then bounced off the boulder and continued to tumble down the mountain at incredible speed, still without any control, finally landing on the service road at the bottom about 200 plus feet from where the fall started. It was the most gruesome fall I have ever witnessed. Daniels quickly took action and sacrificed his own race to help. Immediately ran off the course down to where he landed to see if he was alive, Daniels says. At that moment, I thought there was no way he could have survived what I just witnessed. Terrell was conscious, but bleeding in several places and in obvious pain. Daniels couldn't do much but try to provide a comforting voice. I was the first to arrive and was immediately taken aback by his condition and afraid to move him, Daniels says. Another woman, Megan Ross, an EMT, arrived shortly after, and we managed to prop his head up slightly as he regained consciousness and started working on stopping the bleeding. Within 5 minutes, members of the Snowbird Ski Patrol assigned to the race and trained medical staff took over, applying first aid, checking vitals, and supporting Terrell with a spine board and cervical collar. Within about 30 minutes, he was airlifted by helicopter to the University of Utah Hospital in Salt Lake City. Life really does flash before your eyes, Terrell says. Next thing I remember was waking up in the hospital. the safety dance. While race organizers obviously can't prevent accidents from happening, there are concrete steps they can and generally do to take to mitigate risk, including trail maintenance, adding guardrails and safety officials at cruxes, and having open communication lines and emergency response team at the ready. In fact, such measures are often required to get race permitting in the first place, although safety requirements and protocols vary from state to state. But effective emergency response plan can be the difference between life and death. Indeed, Carr and his team's detailed planning most likely saved Terrell's life. We printed safety maps and provided them to all EMTs, volunteers, and snowbird ski patrol, Carr says. Prior to the race, our safety director, wilderness medicine lead, and snowbird ski patrol met to discuss radio and injury protocol. We placed EMTs and volunteers in positions to efficiently locate injured runners. Ski patrol was on standby for any major medical occurrences. Carr said he is proud of the quick response of his emergency medical teams. EMT staff located in key positions along with Snowbird Ski Patrol positioned at Hidden Peak were able to quickly get Terrell the emergency care he needed. I pride Cirque Series in being very prepared for major and minor medical injuries, Carr says. Our EMTs and Snowbird Patrol arrived to Stewart in very efficient time, just like we train. A new outlet. Anyone who has run in a trail race knows the trail running community is special. Even though it's grown, it feels small and tight-knit. Race winner Allen, a Salt Lake City local, came to visit Terrell in the hospital even though the two had never met. There's something special about runners, Terrell says. In 8th grade, I passed a guy in cross-country race. After the race, he thanked me for pushing him. In what other sport do you get that? The trail community is like that times two. Terrell badly smashed and cut his face during the fall and needed several staples help secure cuts on his head. But doctors determined that he didn't suffer concussion or brain damage. He spent 2 weeks in the hospital before going back home to Virginia. He wasn't able to walk on his own for a month. Said he had to endure two full knee immobilizers for 4 weeks, then a singular knee brace for 8 weeks, and a back brace for 6 weeks. He focused on doctor-prescribed rehab. Running miles were replaced by slow walking. It took me 40 minutes to do 1 mile. I felt so proud. It gave me a new respect for movement, he says. I'm grateful to be alive. And grateful is a good word to express Terrell's unwavering optimism post-fall. When asked why he thinks he fell, he reflects candidly, because I'm a rookie, he admits, but maybe there is a reason. It gave me a different outlook on life. It gave me a new appreciation for being outside, being able to walk. I sprained my right wrist 2 months before this happened. I complained so much, Terrell jokes. That seems harder than all this. Terrell returned to the University of Richmond in the fall and served as graduate assistant coach for the Spiders cross-country program. Amid continued rehab, he ran his first steps 11 weeks post-accident at the beginning of October in the controlled setting of an Alter-G anti-gravity treadmill. In January, he'd be enrolling at Wake Forest while he pursued graduate studies and began a long, slow progression into his final year of collegiate cross-country in the fall. Carr and his team kept in touch with Terrell's coach about his recovery after he returned to Virginia, and they also shipped him a Get Well Soon package. We wish him an ongoing speedy recovery. We're so glad he expected to make a full recovery, Carr says. We hope to see him a future Cirque Race Series race. After he uses up his NCAA eligibility at the end of the 2026 track season, Terrell says he'll definitely continue running, whether competitively or just for fun. He might even return to trail racing, at least the kind with tamer, less technical terrain. But as he builds back into the sport, he's confronted with the obvious question. Is the risk and reward of mountain running worth it, given what he's gone through? For Terrell, the answer is easy. I'll stay on flat ground, he says. Even seeing pictures of people running on cliffs freaks me out. So that was an article on a guy who fell 200 feet in a race. And that was by Andy Wacker, who's a pro road and trail runner based in Boulder, Colorado. And he had represented the U.S. 17 times in 2022. He started the Trail Team, a development organization to support and develop rising athletes into the best professional trail runners in the world. Okay, our next article is entitled Overcrowding is Inevitable on Mount Everest. Here's how climbers deal with it. Veteran guides share tips and tricks for avoiding or navigating the gridlock that always arises on the trail to the top. It's by Ben Ayers. Hundreds of mountain climbers and guides are headed to the summit of Mount Everest to make the most of the first stretch of favorable weather of the 2025 climbing season. Here in base camp, the chatter among expedition leaders is about the traffic jams and conga lines that will soon appear on the mountain. You've probably seen photos of the congestion on Mount Everest with a line of several dozen climbers stretching down an icy slope. This year, approximately 450 climbers are vying for the summit. Often there are twice as many guides, climbing Sherpas, and support climbers to help these clients reach the top. With all these people heading for the summit, crowding is inevitable along the route, which extends 11,400 feet over 5.5 miles. Outspied spoke to expedition operators about the traffic jams, why they occur, and how guides can safely navigate them. Where does gridlock occur and why? Due to the fickle conditions on the world's highest peak, hundreds of climbers embark for the summit at the same time to make the most of the few weather windows that appear each spring. Hundreds of people hike along the same narrow route and use the same safety ropes during the trip. Crown occurs whenever the procession slows down, either because of a tired individual, tricky terrain, or some other obstacle. Guides told us about several areas where bottlenecks arise every year. It's no coincidence that these areas are some of the hardest sections of the route. The first crowded section are the Khumbu Icefall, the cascading glacier that shifts each year as it spills over Mount Everest's lowest flanks. In this twisted section of ice and crevasses, crowds occur next to vertical sections. Climbers use a combination of ladders, fixed ropes, and ascenders called jumars to scale these vertical ice and rock walls, but each person's progress is slow, which causes log jams when people arrive at once. The next section of climbing occurs later in the route near the deep crevasse or bergschrund just below Camp 3 near the top of the Lhotse face. Climbers must ascend the icy and steep top of a glacier before they reach the snowy and stable slopes around camp. Other slowdowns occur just above the Geneva Spur at 27,000 feet, where the slope becomes nearly vertical and has a series of large rocks near the south summit at 28,700 feet. The final section is perhaps the most dangerous, the narrow summit ridge that extends from the Hillary Step to the summit. In 2024, two climbers fell to their deaths while attempting to sidestep crowds in this section. Why it's hard to avoid crowding? Guides on Mount Everest must strike a delicate balance between the demands of clients, some of whom are impatient to get to the summit, and the weather windows on the mountain. Ryan Waters, co-owner of the Boulder, Colorado-based company Mountain Professionals, told me that he informs his clients of his target date for climbing the peak. He also keeps a somewhat flexible schedule in case multiple other teams head up on the same day. There are a few ways to do it. The first is knowing when other groups are potentially leaving and going to summit from conversations you hear in the camps, he said. Secondly, changing up your departure time to try not to be around other groups can help a lot. But Waters admitted this is often easier said than done, since concrete information is hard to come by in base camp. I can attest to his frustration. Throughout base camp, rumors frequently swirl about which group is targeting what date and which climbers are getting ready to ascend the peak. The critical information about congestion on the mountain exists in this rumor mill. Thus, sometimes groups simply cannot avoid the inevitable dynamic of heading onto the peak alongside everyone else. If we get into crowds and it's just a situational management scenario, Walter shared. How to climb in a crowd? I pose the question, how do you navigate crowds? To Mi'kmaq David Sherpa, co-founder of the Elite Epid Guiding Company, as we sat in the mid-morning sunshine and sipped coffee. It's not like a traffic jam with cars in it, he told me. There are often opportunities to overtake or go around slow climbers, but the guide has to know their skills and their client's skills. He described several methods that guides and climbers can employ to pass slower people along the route, all of which involve advanced rope techniques. But these techniques are challenging at higher altitudes when all climbers must clip themselves into the safety ropes. When passing a slower climber, a guide and a client must unclip themselves from the line, pass around the slower climber, and then clip back in. It's not impossible, but it's a technique best left to experienced professionals. Perhaps the most important element of passing is knowing whether or not a client can do it, he said. Having experience as a guide is really important, Mi'kmaq David said. It really helps a lot. I take time on the training rotations to get to know my client's speed and skill. The flow rate of oxygen can also speed up or slow down a client, he said. As we climb, I adjust their oxygen flow rates. We reduce if the climbing slows, increase if the terrain is steep or overhanging, he said. An emphasis on courtesy. All the sources I spoke to echoed a similar point. Yelling at slow climbers never improves or speeds up the crowding. You can adjust your time and start much earlier, Mi'kmaq David said, but the client has paid all that money and they want to be on the top in the daylight. Dutch guide Arnold Koster, who is leading the Seven Summits Trek expedition this year, told me that politeness helps when attempting to overtake someone along the route. It's not that big a deal, especially when everyone's moving upwards together, Koster said. Crowds don't really slow you down. Instead, Koster said that climbers and guides need to focus more on the basics of mountaineering when ascending Mount Everest alongside dozens or hundreds of others. Proper hydration, nutrition, and oxygen support are critical during busy times on the mountain, and guides need to understand that their summit bid may be extended by several hours due to traffic jams. It's like anywhere else in life, Costner said. Remember that a lot of climbers up here become pretty unaware of their surroundings. If you shout at them politely, they'll step aside and let you by. And this was an article on how to avoid the crowds at Everest by Ben Ayers, a filmmaker, journalist, and adventurer who splits the time between Vermont and Nepal. In 2022 and 24, he chronicled the Mount Everest climbing season for Outside. Okay, our next article is entitled, Should We All Just Submit to Our E-Mountain Biking Future? Electric mountain bikes are no longer anomalies on the trail, and some say they'll soon outnumber traditional bikes. If you feel like they escalated quickly, you're not alone. This is by Gloria Liu. It was last fall when I realized that everything had changed. First, there were back-to-back high country rides where my friends and I were the only ones on mountain bikes without motors. Then there was the 11-mile climb where a hiker squinted at my crank set, explained, "No battery?" and began to clap. There was exchange later that day with the only other cyclists we saw riding traditional pedal bikes, who shouted as they passed, "We're a dying breed!" Finally, where there was an encounter at the top of an obscure peak in the Sierras where an older man looked at my bike and said, I remember riding this trail on my analog bike. Depending on who you ask, we are approaching at or past the tipping point for e-mountain bikes. This year, Santa Cruz Bicycles could sell more e-mountain bikes and pedal bikes. The company's product director, Josh Kisner, tells me, specialized turbo Levo model has been his top-selling mountain bike for years, and Cannondale currently has more e-mountain bikes in development than analog. Professional mountain biker Paul Basagonicoitia, who's ridden e-bikes since a 2015 crash at Red Bull Rampage, left him paralyzed, laughed when I asked whether e-mountain bikes were the future of the sport. The future, he said. What do you mean? It's here. It's now. Industry-wide, bike shops still sell more pedal bikes than e-mountain bikes, but product managers from the brands above believe e-bikes will soon represent more than half the bikes on the trail. How much more? Specialized was most bullish when Turbo product director Marco Sonderiger and e-mountain bike product manager Joe Buckley guessing they could become 75 to 80% of the bikes sold. Kisner of Santa Cruz thinks it could be up to two-thirds. Cannondale senior global marketing manager Mike Morrow believes that in the future, analog will have its place, but it will dominate only for specific use cases like cross-country race and downhill categories. How many people are cross-country skiing compared to alpine skiing? Asked Buckley. Rhetorically, that's where it's going to go. The inflection point once seemed impossible, then unlikely, then far off. It is suddenly here. European e-mountain bike models emerged in the early 2010s, but they had kooky bolted-on batteries and carried their weight about as well as a JanSport backpack stuffed with Encyclopedia Britannicas. Specialized is credited for launching the North American e-mountain biking revolution in 2015 when it debuted the sub-50-pounder Turbo Level 6 Fatty with its integrated battery and refined handling, but mountain bikes still had a long road to social acceptance. In 2018, an outside columnist wondered if they were dorkmobiles or savers of the universe. By 2019, however, bike reviewers Aaron Gulley allowed that they come far enough that they're well worth buying. Around 2020 or 2021, Sonderiger says, the Levo began to lead specialized mountain bike business. Today, he tells me, I don't see a way back. How do you feel about this change depends, unsurprisingly, on whether or not you ride an e-mountain bike. Most e-mountain bikers I spoke to said they'd welcome a future in which they're the majority. Duh. Most industry professionals expressed optimism as well, at least outwardly, for a scenario in which e-bikes grow ridership, stoke trail building, and get more Americans exercising. One industry professional admitted that he'd feel a little bit sad if e-mountain bikes one day outnumbered pedal bikes. Then he asked if he could stay anonymous. A lot of longtime riders can probably relate to this sentiment, as well as the reluctance to voice it. It's not really okay to be anti-e-bike anymore. More of us know or love people ride them, many of them who couldn't or wouldn't ride otherwise. If you love the sport, it's tough to criticize gray-haired dads riding with their kids, injured cyclists returning to the trail, or really any rider more readily accessing the joy of mountain biking. It's not really okay to be anti-e-bike anymore. Most of us know or love people who ride them, many of them who couldn't or wouldn't ride otherwise. But also, if you love the sport, you may not want it to change. Many diehard pedal bikers thus find themselves in an awkward position. Just because you support e-mountain bikers doesn't preclude you from dreading their ubiquity or worrying about a future in which they completely take over. It's either naive or disingenuous for people to reduce the debate to ride whatever makes you happy, as if pedal bikers have no stakes in whether they're eventually outnumbered. No one wants to be constantly buzzed on single track by much faster riders, and despite the industry claims that e-mountain bikers don't damage trails mile for mile more than pedal bikes, concerns about overuse by virtue of an e-mountain bike's ability to cover more mileage are legitimate. Mara also tells me that one reason people buy e-bikes is to keep up with their friends. In his view, riders like me could soon have to make a decision. Do I buy another analog bike, or do I get an e-bike so I can keep riding with the group? The product managers I spoke to also agreed that most companies will pare down their pedal offerings if growth continues to lag. Not everyone believes our electric future is a foregone conclusion. Kyle Young, founder of Transition Cycles, for example, doesn't think it'll happen, although even the decidedly core Washington brand sells one e-mountain bike out of every four mountain bikes sold. But whatever the long-term ratio shakes out, we've already hit some undeniable tipping point. The alienating experiences I've had recently would have never been hard to imagine even a year ago. If there was any moment where the e-mountain bike revolution could have stalled, Cannondale Mountain Bike product director Scott Vogelman believes it would have been 5 to 8 years ago, when battles over trail access for e-mountain bikes were mostly hotly contested. Since then, e-mountain bike riders have won access to many trails. At this point, the ball is rolling down the hill, he says. I don't think it's stopping. The Turbo Levo turns 10 this year. As with other technological challenges over the past decade, e-mountain bikes show that we're living in a time when a lot is changing very fast. Now, buoyed by their success, the outdoor industry is experimenting with what else it can motorize. Companies have recently released electronic touring skis, hiking pants with a powered exoskeleton, and electronic tow rope for backcountry skiing. On a Reddit thread about electronic skis, commenters dismissed them as abominations and say they would never be allowed on public lands where most backcountry skiers go. They could be right, but I remember similar conversations when we saw the first e-mountain bikers too. You have been listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I've been reading from Outside Magazine. My name is Dave Rogowski. Thank you for listening.